In this harvest season in California, some farmers are caught between not finding enough workers to do the job and not being able to afford machinery to do the work. Today on Inside, Cap Radio's Nadine Sabai joins me with her reporting on this shift in farm labor. Researchers this week published a massive report on the state of California's education system with a look at everything from charter school oversight to teacher pensions. We'll hear conclusions from the principal investigator, Dr. Susanna Loeb, and the executive director of PACE, Dr. Heather Huff. The podcast Dissect wraps up its season-long focus on two albums by Frank Ocean. We'll recue my conversation with the podcast creator and host. And Soul Collective's Global Local is returning this Saturday to Arden Fair with food, art, music, a cross-cultural celebration. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. This is harvest time for many crops in California, grapes, corn, apples, figs. You might know we're near the end of the pear harvest and the tomato harvest. Of course, there are many, many more. And generations of field workers have picked many of these crops by hand. Machines now do a lot of the work. Some California farmers, though, are in that gap in between, not being able to afford the modern machinery, but not finding enough workers to complete the harvest by hand. Cap Radio reporter Nadine Sabai has been reporting on what I'll call a transition in farm labor in California. Hi, Nadine. Glad to have you here in the studio.
Thank you so much.
I'm calling it a transition, but this is not a new problem.
It's not. Farmers in California have been having a hard time finding workers for years now, and it's been most hard hit by growers that rely heavily on manual labor. Mm. So soybean or corn farmers, they mostly rely on machines. But some farmers, unfortunately, don't have that luxury. So avocado growers that I spoke to, cut flower farmers, and Barton Bengard, he grows lettuce, cauliflower, celery. All of those crops require them to be picked by hand. And so I actually visited Barton Bengard's broccoli farm during harvesting season, and we were looking at his workers and the men with large knives cutting the crop and women up above on the machine packing. And he told me ideally he'd have about 30 workers harvesting crops. But on that day, he only had half the workers he needed.
The challenge is we're just learning how to do more with less, but we're at a breaking point where we're not able to fill that gap with technology or people. So everything's being kind of driven to a hyper sensitive rate, right? Where you, if you have one mistake, you can't recover.
I think there are variations to that story across the state. And it might seem obvious that changes to the immigration laws contributed to the worker shortage, but that's not the only factor.
No. And from the farmers and experts that I've spoken to, they tell me that it comes down to a few issues. The first is an aging workforce. So the average California farmer is 39 years old, and they've usually probably worked for the same farmer for decades. They have a family, they have kids. But the thing is, they're getting older, and their children, they don't want to work in agriculture anymore. I spoke to Mark Villanueva, who works with Bengard, and he's been in agriculture for over 40 years.
Kids, they don't want to come and do this. It's pretty tough work. And that's why the labor shortage is so short. Even the second generation immigrants, their kids said they don't want to do this.
So the average farm worker now is 39 years old.
That's right. And also the rise in minimum wage and federal government stalling on immigration reform are also major contributors to this shortage.
You've heard this story from other farmers and the situation I described where they're caught in the middle between what to do in the ways before and what to do in the technology and the modern equipment that's ahead. If they can't move to the machines and they're caught, as that farmer was, with half the force they need, what are the answers? What's the solution in the gap?
Well, it's hard because a lot of times I have heard people say, well, why don't they just resort to machines? Why don't just farmers build machines and grow them? And what I've been told is that labor mechanization is a process of trial and error, not an event. And what that means is that in order to get a machine to harvest a crop, that is grown in nature, that is difficult, that has climate issues, that has soil problems. It requires an investment from researchers, engineers, businessmen, money, government. And they all have to get together, and the farmers, they all have to get together and they have to say, yes, we want to invest in this. And even if that agreement is made, it's still going to take years of trial and error before that machine actually can replace a human being. I asked Barden if he thinks the investment is worth it.
We can't replace the hand-eye that we rely on people to make decisions when they're cutting a product. They have to look at that product and decide, is this ready to harvest or not? And that's where a lot of the people here you're seeing today, that's what they're specialists at. The human brain has a good function. You can't replace it all with machinery.
The history of mechanization of farm labor is actually quite a heated one. In my story, which you can check out on our website, I delve into the invention of the mechanized tomato harvester, which was created by two UC Davis researchers in the 1960s. It led to a 10-year legal battle, and it dramatically changed the future of mechanization research in the U.S.
I think many people respect and want that idea preserved, the idea that Barden said you can't replace everything with machinery. And do many people believe there's always going to be a place for a human being, for a worker in the field that is a person as opposed to all mechanized?
It depends who you speak to. I think if you speak to an engineer, they'll say the future is technology. The future is all technology. There'll be farms that are solely run by machines. But if you speak to farmers on the ground, Barden in particular, he doesn't believe that humans can be replaced, at least not completely. And he doesn't want to see it that way.
Does it depend, too, on the size of the farm? I don't remember you saying acreage for his farm in particular, but surely the bigger farms are more standardized and machinery and technology would be needed for that harvest.
That's right. That's a really good point. So one of the big issues in terms of labor mechanization is the acreage of the crop that you're growing. So the reason why soybean and corn and wheat, not only are they easier to grow, but the reason why they have so much technology research going towards them is because they take up millions and millions
fields
and millions of acres.
Fields,
yes, there's a lot of money to make there. But for lettuce farmers and for specialty crop growers, for broccoli, cauliflower, those are what are called specialty crops. And, you know, for someone to put their money in lettuce technology versus other technology that can make more money, you know, it's kind of you have to make that decision.
I'm talking with CAP Radio reporter Nadine Sabai. You can find more of the report that we're talking about, more of her work at capradio.org. Let's take a look then to the future. What does the future look like for farmers in California?
Well, it's not all doom and gloom, thankfully. Mechanization research has picked up over the last decade, but it is mostly led by private sector and their engineers working with large farmers. I spoke to Dr. Philip Martin, who's an agricultural economist at UC Davis, and he told me that farmers are responding to this labor shortage with what he calls the 4S strategies, and I'll just quickly go through them. The first is farmers are satisfying current workers with higher wages and bonuses, so essentially incentives. They're stretching their current workers with mechanical aids that don't eliminate people completely, but they make them more productive. This is something that Barden Vanguard has been doing a lot. The third thing is substituting machines for workers completely. We've talked about that and how difficult it is. And the last one is supplementing new workers through guest worker visa programs. Dr. Martin also gave me a glimpse into what a trip to the grocery store could look like as farmers are forced to become less and less reliant on human labor.
Instead of having just organic and regular strawberries, we're going to have to go machine-picked and hand-picked because the machine-picked will have more bruises and damage. They may be cheaper. And we have to see whether the market accepts that or not. So the key to unlocking machines is not necessarily size. It's how the market is going to evolve.
And Martin says that every time he suggested this mechanization, non-mechanization option to stores, they tell him that, you know, that would be great, but all growers either use machines or human labor. So he tells me it's kind of like a chicken or the egg problem,
so to speak, here as we talk about farming. I was thinking about strawberries, and it's one thing to think about a machine shaking an almond tree and shaking out the ripe almonds, but to think about completely machine picking a field of strawberries. In some ways, the planting, the growing, the accessibility of the plant and where the fruit is, more has to change than just putting the technology in the field.
That's right. Ben Gard mentioned that. He always said Mother Nature is always in control. And if they were operating in a factory setting, creating this technology would be possible. But the reality is, for strawberries and for lettuce and for such delicate crops, it's a difficult machine to be able to invent. Also, the market is very picky, you know, so how we're going to figure that out is going to be pretty difficult in the future.
Can I go back to one point you made in the 4S strategy, and that is supplementing new workers through guest worker visa programs? No one anticipates that we'll ever get to the number of workers that we had before, correct?
That's correct.
So in bringing in new workers, is there a thought, though, that maybe a new generation could be inspired to want to participate in this kind of work?
It's difficult to say. I mean, you know, the new generation now has a lot of different options. They can work in restaurants, especially now that the economy is doing well. They can work in a restaurant. They can work in a cafe and get paid maybe a little bit less, but they won't have to work as hard. Barden even told me that in Mexico, he has people down there, that even in Mexico, they're having a hard time finding Mexican workers to work in Mexican farms. Mm. And so it's not only a California, a U.S. second generational problem. It's just a shift, you know. And one thing, Mark Villanueva, who I spoke to, who works with Ben Gard, he actually brought his son to work in the fields just to kind of experience it. And he told me that it woke up his son and he said, you know what, I need to go to college. I don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. And for him, it was like he kind of had this dual thought process about it, which was, you know, agriculture was his life. But also he understands that you don't want to say a better life for your kid, because it's not to say that. But what he says was, you know, he wants an easier life. And that should be OK, you know.
All right, Nadine, I'll again refer people to the website where there's more of the story. And I think in a broad sense, you've been looking at tariffs, you've been looking at the ag industry overall. So there's a good body of work there. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
That is Nadine Sabai, CAP Radio reporter, and her work is at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. California needs to do more to address the achievement gap of English learners. That's one of the significant findings in a broad research project titled Getting Down to Facts 2, released this week. By the number 2, you can probably tell it is a sequel, and in fact it is, to the original Getting Down to Facts, which was published in 2007. So this new report includes analysis of more than 30 different studies of reforms in pre-K to 12 education in California. And these studies looked at variations and factors over the past 10 years. We're going to talk through some of the conclusions. On the phone with us is the principal investigator of the project, Dr. Susanna Loeb. She is director of the Annenberg Institute and professor of education and international and public affairs at Brown University. Dr. Loeb, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me here today, Beth. It's a pleasure.
In the studio with me is Dr. Heather Huff. She is executive director of PACE, the Policy Analysis for California Education. Dr. Huff, glad you're here as well.
Thank you so much.
So, Dr. Loeb, many studies were analyzed looking at similar and sometimes different factors related to California's education system. To you, what was both consistent and profound across the landscape?
Oh, that's a great question. So I think three things really stood out to us. The first is that California's undergone tremendous shifts. They've included redoing the school funding formula to the local control funding formula, introducing new accountability system and new standards and new performance metrics. And we found that these reforms had resulted in improvements and that there was strong and really broad support, both among educators and the public, for these changes. And so in that way, one of the main stories is that we just need to build on these reforms. There isn't quite the capacity yet to put the reforms fully into place, but the start is right there. So one of the findings is certainly that there's been some improvements over the last 10 years, and it would be important to build on reforms. The second is really what you pointed to, which is the need to address achievement gaps. We have really large achievement gaps, not only between English learners and other students, but by race, ethnicity, and income. And we really need a continued focus through multiple approaches, including enhanced early childhood education. So the second is that there were large achievement gaps. And then the third really has to do with funding. The system really needs increased funding if California is going to reach the goals that it set for students. And there are issues that, even with all the changes that have gone on, there are these critical issues that haven't been addressed, and in particular, pensions and special education funding. So I think we're really on the right track, but we've got these great needs, and part of that's going to be addressing early childhood education funding and then fixing some of these structural issues.
Dr. Huff, let me get to the first point that Dr. Loeb made, which was about improvements. And you looked in particular at a phrase, continuous improvements in the education system. And I imagine there's a good side to that and a bad side to that. What did your study show?
One of the big changes that has occurred across our system in the past 10 years is a shift from the state to local control. That's true both in terms of how funding decisions are made, but also in terms of how decisions are made generally about how to support students better. And one of what that requires is capacity building across the system to really enact that kind of improvement. The approach that the state is focused on using is called continuous improvement. That's a phrase that appears a lot in policy documents. And essentially, what it means is that you need locally to build the capacity both to understand what the problems are and think about solutions to those problems. And a key piece of that is good data so that you can really locally understand what you need to fix.
Dr. Loeb, building capacity can take a long time. And we've been hearing for at least the last decade, emphasized leading up to the gubernatorial primary, about low test scores, low graduation rates, or high dropout rates, and low per pupil funding. So if my child, for example, is just going into high school, I'm thinking about the next 4 years. What's the bigger picture of how fast the system can move toward that improvement?
That's a great question. So California really has been making some improvements. So if you look at test scores over time, those have been going up relative to the nation at an increasing rate, and graduation rates have been going up. So we've made some progress, but we're still not as good even as the national average. So I do think there's reasons to be hopeful. The kinds of reforms that have been put in that have all of this support really do have the potential to improve the educational opportunities for students, and steps have been made towards that right now. So educators are getting the kinds of professional development that they think they need much more than they were in the past. However, because California is a relatively high-cost place to run schools, we really do have very few adults in schools. We have very few mental health supports or health supports in schools relative to other states. So I do think it's going to take an influx to kind of keep this positive movement going forward.
Dr. Loeb, I know we only have a few minutes left with you. I'd like to get to two questions. The first is, where are California children by the time they enter kindergarten?
Yes, so that was, I think, one of the important findings, is we have very big achievement gaps in California, but these achievement gaps are really evident when kids enter kindergarten, which points to the importance of the kinds of educational opportunities they're getting as very young children. And so one of the the big studies in this overall project focused on early childhood education. And there's a place where California isn't doing as well as many states in the country in terms of having a coordinated effort to provide good early childhood education for kids.
Are California kids, by and large, already behind many other states by the time they get to kindergarten?
Well, it's more that the achievement gaps are really quite large when they get to kindergarten. So if you look across districts and you take the wealthier districts in California, children in those more affluent districts are doing as well as kids are doing in the nation as a whole. But if you look at the lower income districts, there we're really not doing as well. So those gaps between the different districts are really what separates California from the rest of the country. And I think targeting some of the efforts there would be one approach to try to reduce the achievement gaps and really pull up the whole state.
Give me some context then, as a final question here, to what the 2007 report showed and whether we're just in a continuation of trends then, or have we in some ways been in a worsening situation?
Oh, I actually think we've been in quite an improving situation. So not a worsening situation. We just haven't improved nearly as much as we would like to improve. We have strong goals, ambitious goals for students, and in order to meet them, we really need a strong education system. In 2007, we found a very illogical school finance and governance system. So very similar districts were getting different amounts of money from the state, and it was really hard to understand why. There's been a lot of rationalization. The new finance policies and the new accountability policies are much better thought out and easier to follow than they were before. So I think we really are on a better path and have set the foundations. It's just that foundations aren't enough. We really need to push to build the kind of capacity we need to take these foundations and turn them into better outcomes for students.
Dr. Loeb, thank you so much for your time. We'll post a link for everybody to go through the study. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me and for your interest in this topic.
That is the principal investigator of Getting Down to Facts 2. She is Dr. Susanna Loeb, director of the Annenberg Institute. Still with me in the studio is Dr. Heather Huff, the executive director of PACE. So, Dr. Huff, who's the target audience for this information?
It's a great question. The shift from policymaking in Sacramento to local policymaking and decision making has really meant that there's a very broad audience for this set of studies. We're interested in getting this evidence into the hands of school district leaders, community organizations, advocates, statewide organizations, state policymakers, and also regional and network leads who support the improvement of local folks. So there's so many really detailed findings about what needs to happen moving forward, and the audience for it is quite large.
Do you share Dr. Loeb's view that there's a lot of encouragement in this report compared to where we were in 2007?
Absolutely. I think we've seen a lot of big improvements. And I also think that we talked to a lot of people across the state through these 36 studies. And these various people, educators, decision makers, are also very supportive about the progress that they're making and that they see possible as a result of these changes. I think that we still have the challenge that people want and need to build the capacity to make this shift, to really exercise their local decision making. And there's hunger for that. And there's also a lot of current movement around building those structures and supports.
Funding wasn't your particular emphasis or area of study in this overall project, but I know we didn't have any more time with Dr. Loeb. I do want to touch on the fact that educator pensions were looked at across the state, and to the extent that they are related to budget problems, funding issues that were highlighted in the report, what can be said about educator pensions, especially as we look to the future?
Well, what I can tell you is that as a result of the work that I did, I talked to a lot of local policymakers and leaders, and this issue is one that's hitting them very hard. And so the study that is, we have a study as part of Getting Down to Facts that really gets into the numbers on this and what it looks like and what some potential solutions are. But what we're seeing at the local level is that there is a sense generally that there's more money in the system, and there is. But this pension liability is something that's making the local decision makers feel much more strapped than the numbers themselves show. And that problem is getting worse. And so it's something that they feel a lot of stress about.
The way you're describing it, it's not as if it's being ignored, pushed on the back burner. The way you're talking about it seems to tell me that districts across the state are looking at it as that ever-present dark cloud that's hanging right there that there's no solution to right now.
That's right. And I think there's a lot. It's something that people know about and that I think there is will to solve. But it's not an easy problem to solve.
When the team came together, and I probably should have explained this a little more in the beginning, which was that this was an overview of more than 30 studies that had already been done. So you all came together a couple times to compare notes, talk about the different aspects that you were working on. What for you was a surprise, or to some of the others, was there a sense of surprise about?
So it was a really fantastic group, over 100 researchers across the state and across the country involved in this effort. We came together twice to learn from each other and to really push on each other's research as a way to strengthen it and make sure that we had a really comprehensive set of findings. There was surprise coming out of the research, but there also was just evidence, real fact coming out of it. So sometimes when you talk to people in school districts, there's a general sense, I'm having trouble with my teachers. I'm having trouble recruiting and retaining them. I'm having trouble with pensions. And what this set of studies did is put rigor on all of those feelings that were happening across the state. And so in a lot of ways, I mean, there are new pieces, and Susanna talked about some of those, the achievement gaps starting in kindergarten, some more detail about pensions and funding. But a lot of it was the aggregation of all of this evidence into a set of studies that makes it very concrete and very real and enables that now to be the new baseline through which we evaluate what needs to happen.
My colleague, Nadine Sabai, worked on a story related to this report when it was released earlier this week, highlighting that achievement gap in English learners in the state, that the gap is wider than it should be or needs to be. Another factor with regard to charter schools, that California creates a difficulty in the establishment of charter schools, not necessarily the performance of students in the schools, but just dealing with the rules and the beginnings of a charter school becoming an institution that kids can go to school to, opening the doors. Mm-hmm. So in light of that, are there solutions posed by this report?
That's a great question. Our reports as a set were very deliberate to stop before we say what folks should do. And the reason for that is very clear. Our job as researchers, as academics, as scholars, is to provide the evidence. And it's the job of the people making the decisions to decide what to do about that. Because in a lot of the studies, we lay out potential options that other states have taken, for example. What our state decides to do is a political question. It's a community question. And so we want to be there to provide what people need to make those smart decisions.
So your hope is that this becomes an important tool for policymakers.
That's right. And policymakers really at all levels.
All right, Dr. Huff, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate that we had this conversation, although it seems like it's just part one.
I hope so.
We'll have a sequel as well. And we will post a link for people to spend much more time with this report in detail. That will be at capradio.org/insight. Dr. Heather Huff is Executive Director of PACE, which is the Policy Analysis for California Education. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, Beth.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Maybe we turned you on to the podcast Dissect because we have featured its host and creator, Cole Kushna, since he started the series 3 years ago. In each of the seasons through his podcast, he breaks down the musical and biographical stories of an album. And this year, Dissect episodes focused on albums by Frank Ocean, Channel Orange, and Blonde. So the two-part season finale of the podcast series posted on Spotify this Monday. We thought we'd revisit my conversation with Cole from when this third season began. And you're going to hear him answer my question, which was, why this time around, why Frank Ocean?
I would say, first off, his music is just beautiful and incredible and deserves dissection. And it was also a very highly requested artist by current Dissect listeners. They're very passionate about Frank Ocean, so they pushed me in his direction for sure.
So let's listen to a bit of the podcast. This is from episode one, and it starts with a small portion of Frank Ocean's song, White Ferrari.
In this life, in this life.
We'll also discover how with each project came parallel acts of liberation in Ocean's personal and public life. From the independent release of his self-funded mixtape Nostalgia Ultra, to the touching open letter that publicly revealed his sexuality days before the release of Channel Orange, to his reclusive withdrawal from the trappings and falsities of fame in the 4 years before Blonde, both Frank Ocean's art and his actions move in parallel along a self-created path towards artistic truth, creative purity, and personal and financial independence.
There was an article, Cole, titled, Is It Futile to Dissect Frank Ocean's Work? And the writer, Hannah Jorgis, writes, it's unclear whether Dissect will eventually offer up new reportage on Frank Ocean, but so far, the depth and breadth of Kushna's research is impressive. Where and how far did you go to study Frank Ocean and his music?
Yeah, the reportage is interesting because I think it implies, like, you know, am I going to talk to Frank Ocean? Am I going to talk to producers and kind of bring new material into the world? And that would be great. But Dissect's focus is really on the music. And I try to keep it as true to the music as possible. And I really use the music first for everything. So while the first couple episodes are a little bit more introductory and there's more biographical research that goes on with those episodes, once we get to the music, I'm more interested in pulling details that are in the music specifically. And that's my main focus.
Let's do a little example of this. We're going to play a little clip of Pink and White, a Frank Ocean song. And then when we come out of the clip, I'd like you to do a little of what you do in the podcast,
sure.
Okay?
Time we've no control. If the sky is pink and white, if the ground is black and yellow, it's the same way you showed me. Nod my head, don't close my eyes. Halfway on a slow move, it's the same way you showed me.
All right, Cole, you're on.
Yeah, no pressure. No, there's a lot of interesting things going on there. You know, musically, it was produced by Pharrell, who's very well-known artist. It actually features backing vocals from Beyonce that you don't even know is there unless you really listen closely, and you don't even couldn't really tell it's Beyonce. She doesn't even say any words, which kind of speaks to the way that Frank Ocean utilizes artists. So if you look at the contributor members of this album, Blonde, it's like the star-studded laundry list of like who's who in the music industry. But the way he utilizes those people, you would never really know that they're on the record. For instance, he has orchestral arrangements by Radiohead's Johnny Greenwood. Just the way that he's able to put these collaborators in the same room together and what he brings out of them is just such a gift.
That's Cole Kushna. He just described exactly why the podcast Dissect is so fascinating. Season 3 focuses on the music of Frank Ocean. And Cole, congratulations, you were just hired by Spotify. So now this is really your day job, isn't it?
I worked for Temple Coffee Roasters for 6 years, and I was doing the podcast at night for the first two seasons. And, you know, fortunately, Spotify came around and offered me basically the opportunity to do Dissect as my full-time job. So it was, that was always the goal. That was always the intention. And it happened, which is great.
And last year ended up being that real transformative year for you. It was named Podcast of the Year. Season 2 was by Quartz. And you were profiled in a lot of national magazines. So one thing that I like about this new season is that you go into the history of mixtapes and you talk about the evolution with cassette tapes and all of that connection to hip hop. So you have parallel history and exploration going on.
Yeah, I think it's important to contextualize contemporary music with history. I think it provides different entry points for people that maybe aren't familiar with the music or don't listen to it. I think it maybe makes itself more accessible in that way if you know some of the historical roots to it. And I've kind of learned to follow my intuition on those things. And something like that catches my attention, like, oh, well, how does this mixtape apply to this current mixtape and how do we get here? I've learned to kind of follow those threads and put them in the show because, you know, people end up, you know, really liking those segments.
What albums were you considering before you ended up choosing Frank Ocean's work?
Tyler, the Creator's Flower Boy, which is not a crazy well-known album, came out last year, was one that was in heavy consideration. Beyoncé's Lemonade was also heavy consideration. But Frank Ocean was always high on the list, and it was more about which Frank Ocean record I was going to do, Channel Orange or Blonde. And I ended up picking both, kind of. So I'm doing a mini-series on Channel Orange, which will be 6 episodes, and then 12 episodes on Blonde.
So because of your relationship with Spotify, the podcast launched there first. There's also exclusive bonus episodes that will happen on Spotify that aren't on every format, correct?
Yeah, and those are going to be fun. They'll kind of augment the regular episodes, but kind of cutting room floor stuff and then also maybe more personal thoughts. A lot of times on the actual show, I kind of keep myself out of it, but I've learned that listeners are curious about what I think personally. So the bonus episodes will be a fun place to kind of experiment with new segments.
With that, I'm going to quote again from the article, Is It Futile to Dissect Frank Ocean's Work? Because Hannah writes, Dissect is enthralling not because it speaks for its subject, but because Kushna connects disparate threads and amplifies the artist's voice in the process. She talks about your deep written work and analysis. What did you come away with being amazed or understanding about Frank Ocean that you didn't know going in?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I didn't know too much about him. Unlike Kendrick and Kanye before, who I was already a really big fan of, Frank Ocean, I had always liked his music, but not on the level of Kendrick Lamar for me personally. So a lot of this has been learning. And I guess the thing that really impresses me about him, his art and his personal life really align towards this seeking of truth and authenticity. He's not someone that you're going to see at award shows or doing a lot of these more celebrity-oriented events. He's creating art. He's putting art into the world. He doesn't do interviews, and he really just lets the art speak for itself. And that really impressed me. And he lives that out in his personal life and his music. And I thought that was just really inspiring for me.
With all three of the artists you've focused on, you do address the relationships with fame. And all three, Kendrick, Kanye, and Frank, have handled it dramatically differently, haven't they?
Yeah, and that's kind of another reason why I picked Frank Ocean, because there is this through line of fame and how you deal with fame on all these artists. And yeah, exactly what you said. They all deal with it different ways. Kendrick is kind of in between what Kanye is and Frank. So Frank's just, you know, disregarded it completely. Kanye feeds off of it clearly. And Kendrick's kind of in the middle and doing something very graceful and balancing it very well. Fame has always been a really interesting subject for me and what it does to people, because it does a number on most people.
Well, you're living an increasing amount of it yourself.
The podcast fame is more anonymous. It's great.
That was Cole Kushner talking about his podcast series Dissect, which just is finishing this week, the focus being on Frank Ocean and his music. The first season, by the way, examined Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly. The second season, Kanye West's My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. Dissect podcast is going to launch a special mini-series this fall to mark the 20th anniversary of the miseducation of Lauryn Hill. There's more at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio.
That's the way every day goes. Every time we've no control. If the sky is pink and white, if the ground is black and yellow, it's the same way you showed me. Nod my head, don't close my eyes. Halfway on a slow move, it's the same way you showed me. If you could fly, then you'd feel south. Up north, it's getting cold soon. The way it is, we're on land, so I'm someone to hold true. Keep you cool when it's still alive. Won't let you down when it's all ruined. Just the same way you showed me. Showed me. You showed me love. Glory from above. Regardless, dear. It's all.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Outside on that open top floor of the Nordstrom parking ramp at Arden Fair Mall in Sacramento this Saturday, there will be a whole lot of fun. It's the Global Local Festival with art, music, great food, great cultural experiences. It's what you might call a pop-up festival. It's geared to the whole family. It's a chance to highlight some of the diversity that's in our area. And Ruby Avila from Soul Collective is here to preview the event. Hi, Ruby.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This is a festival that happens in Austin, Texas. It happens in New York on Staten Island.
Yes.
And you've had a little bit of experience with it in other places.
I have.
So tell me how it started and what it's becoming.
Yes. Yeah, so Global Local actually started kind of as an idea to really just map out who we have in the community, especially just because we do a lot of similar things in activism and in just artistry. And so we really wanted to really highlight that and figure out who's doing similar work so we can bring them together and really just show the community and just build upon that. And that's kind of what Global Local is just all about.
As an event, it started at South by Southwest,
it
I think.
Did.
Didn't it?
Yeah. And that was one of the major ones just because now, because of that event, we are officially on like South by Southwest. And for that, it was really just bringing like global sound into South by Southwest because you wouldn't really see cultural diversity within all the lineups that was there. Even it's like one of the biggest music festivals, you don't really see that. And so we really wanted to highlight those artists, bring them to South by Southwest. And even on top of that, we were actually really close with just finding activists within the community in Austin and bringing them also into Global Local and just do community work in addition just to the lineup that was already there. Yeah.
What you're saying surprises me about South by Southwest, really. The festival came to Sacramento in 2014. I see so much diversity in this studio, in our local music scene.
Yeah.
So probably introducing the idea wasn't the issue. It's more a celebration of it and bringing the artist to the people. Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's the lineup musically for Saturday night?
So this Saturday, we're going to have Philharmonic, Gingy, which is an incredible artist. She is from L.A., actually. She's a DJ, a producer, a vocalist, and she brings she combines her Filipino traditional sounds with just electronic music and hip hop. And so it's just going to be amazing. And we're going to have a lot of performances, culture performances, ballet folklorico. We're going to have some African drummers. And we're also going to have a blessing from an Aztec dancing group just to really like set the tone of the space and just welcome everybody.
There's a henna lounge, I think.
Yes, we're still working on that.
Okay.
Yeah. The Geodome is one of the greatest like attractions in any event that we have. It's just this big Geodome. We usually set it up as a healing space, but this time we want to do a little different, yeah.
So it's a maybe at this
point. It's a maybe, yes.
Okay. How about the Mexican Painter Studio?
Yes. So that one is a for sure. We're super excited about that one. We're actually Frida Kahlo inspired. And so it's a La Casa Azul. And so we're going to have a few different stations inside. So we're going to have a self-portrait station. And so we're going to have mirrors. Yeah. And then you'll just be able to paint yourself based on what you see. And then as well as a paper mache doll station. So you'll be able to make your own Frida Kahlo paper mache doll and take it home with you. And then we're also going to have like a little flower crown station, which everybody loves. I even love that one.
This is a free event.
Yes, that's definitely what we want to emphasize. It's free event. The admission, the parking, all the activities are completely free. And so we really just want to encourage everybody to come out. And especially in all the art activities that we're going to have, we really want to engage both like the kids and the parents. Like we really want to emphasize like it's for all ages.
We're talking about Global Local, and the festival is on that top floor of the Nordstrom parking ramp at Arden Fair Mall in Sacramento. If you've never been there, it's actually behind the mall.
Yeah.
So do drive around. The event is from 5 to 9 o'clock. I'm talking with Ruby Avila from Soul Collective. Ruby, can you tell me a little of your own personal story and how culture became important? I don't know how much your family highlighted this or made it important for you,
yes.
But because you're an adult, you had to make some discoveries on your own.
Will you share a little of that with me?
Yeah,
of course. So I actually started interning at Soul Collective when I was 16.
Wow.
Yeah. And from there, just being more engaged with the community and just my own personal background. Both my parents are immigrants from Mexico City. And just growing up, they've always made it important to show me where I come from and just like my cultural aspect of like who I am. And I've always been grateful for that because now I'm just like, oh, it's like really a big part of my identity. And just growing up through Soul Collective and working with my community and then just tying in social issues with like who I am and just part of my background, it really like made a path for me and like what I wanted to do, even just going to college, like anthropology. I was super into agriculture and food justice. And so that was a big part of me just because where I grew up in Oak Park, there wasn't much food accessibility, just in organic food or healthy organic food.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just what I wanted to do. And then thanks to Soul Collective, like I've been able to really just make change in that and then bring it back to my community as well.
Did you finish college?
I did. From UC Santa Cruz. Yeah, thank you. First to my family. It's always a big accomplishment.
How free do you feel in living your cultural background and who you are, and where do you run up against some challenges in that?
Yeah, definitely when I went to college, I think that was difficult just because it was very segregated, I think. Just seeing that, and like I came from such a tight-knit community, Sacramento, Soul Collective, like everybody knows everybody. And we all do similar work. And so just making that transition was just super difficult. And like, whoa, like I have to really find my place again.
To which campus? Where were you?
UC Santa Cruz. Yeah.
Santa Cruz, you experienced that?
Yeah. Hmm. It's a small town, but it's different.
And now what works in passing the message on, in finding ways to empower young people, men and women, to discover more about their own heritage and celebrate their own culture?
I think events like Global Local, actually, just really promoting just the art. And because we use art a lot to educate others about what's going on politically or who we are. And so I think just making it more known and just putting it out there and having these kinds of events in the community and showing that you can be proud of where you come from or who you are. And I think that's just like incredible.
So tick off some of the cultures that are represented at Global Local this weekend.
Cool. Yeah, of course. So a lot of the Latinx community, we're going to have some African drummers, some Celtic, a booth of Celtic culture, and then I think some Filipino. Yeah, a lot. We're really trying to nail a little bit of everything.
Well, and the Philharmonic comes with a mix of backgrounds,
exactly.
His African-American background.
Yeah.
And I think that as opposed to saying who is what, it's
exactly.
Just the mix of experiencing mm-hmm. all of it.
Precisely.
All right. So it's art, it's music, it's great food, it's cultural exposure and experience, and it's all happening on top of the parking ramp behind Arden Fair Mall in Sacramento this Saturday night, 5 to 9. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anything
Can I
else?
Mention, yeah,
sure.
I did want to mention something else. We actually finalized that. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Willie Cauley Stein.
Yeah,
Sacramento.
Sure.
Yeah, Sacramento Kings player.
Yeah.
He's co-sponsoring art kits. And so the first 100 youth that come by are going to have free art kits to take home.
Oh, that's
yeah.
great. Is he going to be there too?
I'm not entirely sure on that yet.
Well, we should
yeah.
say
yeah.
say that right now.
Yeah.
Come on, Willie. You're such a good community supporter.
Yes,
can you
he's
stop
great.
By?
He's great.
Anyway, well, that was really a terrific. So thanks
yeah,
so much,
thank
Ruby.
You
glad
for
to have you
me.
Here. Thanks for sharing a little of
awesome.
Your own background
thank
as
you.
Well. That's Ruby Avila. Again, Soul Collective will post a link with more information at capradio.org/insight. That's Insight for today. We are back with another live show tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.